So at a time of, when we're, the federal government is considering nationalizing God knows what by the time they're done, it seemed a little funny to say, well, we'll have a session on privatization because, most people's response, I think, is, but aren't we busy nationalizing right now? So I'm going to sort of take a roundabout way over the next 10 or 15 minutes to explain why, in fact, actually, there still is a lot of privatization going on, and then Len will prove it by talking about all the privatization that we're actually working on. Step one in this sort of trail is that you have to think about how something changes within policy or within the government, and which dictates sort of how reason works when it comes to actually implementing policy change. You need a number of things. First of all, the idea has to be out there. There has to be something, some clear, well-articulated idea, aka privatization. People have to understand what it is and that, in fact, it has worked. So we do a lot of that. I mean, that's what David mentioned, privatization and annual privatization watch and annual privatization report and the many articles, studies, op-eds, and other things that Len and I and others on the staff write. That's all primarily about just banging that drum. Hey, this idea exists. Listen up. Anybody out there interested in this idea? The other thing is you need someone actually in the government because you can't change things. Policies don't change from outside. They change from inside. Somebody in the government has to be what we call a motivated customer, which means they want to do the right policy and they're looking for some help to do it. And so we're always looking for those folks. And even in times like these, there are lots of those folks. And I'll loop around to why that's so sort of at the end. But I wanted to spend some time on the problem that sets up this, that's a slice of the problem you probably haven't heard or thought about. Cliff dive that we're all going through right now that was so disgustingly illustrated in that video last night. Really made, I drank twice as much wine as I normally would after that. thank goodness Manny picked good wines. That dive we're going off, I mean, that reverberates down through the economy in all kinds of ways that are extremely hard to see and are very poorly covered by the media. So we've been doing some analysis of state and local budgets. And particularly as we come into this crisis, we work at that level enough where we just know, because we see these budget numbers all constantly in our work and our meetings with government, we're like, it's been boom times for state and local government. How can they be in a crisis all of a sudden and need this gigantic bailout from the federal government? So we thought, well, we need to take our sort of decentralized and knowledge and really crunch the numbers. So I just want to give you a quickie overview because it's pretty illustrative. Between 2002 and 2007, we had a steady period of economic growth. So once the post 9/11 downturn was over, we had 5 solid years of economic growth. And so we looked at that period leading up to 2008 when the economy started to experience troubles. The starting logic that we apply is states argue that when economic times are tough, like now, we need to increase state spending, right? Because there's more demand for state services. I mean, that's even leaving aside the stimulus argument that spending more is going to actually help the economy recover. Generally speaking, demands for state services go up and local government services when the economy is in tough times. That makes pretty obvious sense. Conversely, though, when you're in an economic boom, there's less demand for state services. But if you map state spending, it doesn't go up in bad times and down in good times. It just goes up. Funny how that works, right? Between 2002 and 2007, you won't be surprised that even though it was boom economic times, unemployment fell, about 1.5% during that time. There was no decrease in the state's expressed need to provide service. There may have been a decrease in the demand for their services, but they weren't cutting back. Total revenue for state governments, and we're using states, essentially local governments, so much of their revenue flows from state government that their trends tend to mirror state revenue and spending trends pretty closely, with the exception of the largest cities, which are a special case. So I'm going to mostly just talk about state-level trends, and that captures the whole thing. So total state revenue in 2002 was $1 trillion. In 2007, it was $2 trillion. In real terms, it's an 81% increase over that five-year period. During that five-year period, inflation and population increased 19%. So revenue outpaced the growth in demand, so to speak. Assuming that to a certain extent, if you're providing basic services, they scale to inflation and population, which is what most people assume. Obviously, revenue growth much, much higher than the growth in the economy. The analogy, nice analogy, one of the staff came up with is if you're earning $50,000 in 2002, with that growth, if you had experienced the same rate of growth as the economy, then in 2007 you would have been making just under $60,000. Pretty respectable. If your neighbor, Mr. State Government, was making $50,000 in 2002, by 2007, he'd be making $90,500. So something like four times the increase in income that a person who grew with the economy would experience. Over that five-year period, states collected $2.2 trillion more than would be required to have increased their revenue at pace with population and inflation growth. So they had this $2.2 trillion sort of bonus over what you needed to maintain the level of services in 2002. Now, these state governments argue, yeah, but, you know, we shouldn't be just maintaining services at 2002 levels. We should be improving. Because we all remember what hell it was in 2002. You know, people living on the streets, mass famine and death. Thank goodness the state is increasing its spending to avoid that hell of 2002 again. So, you know, one way of looking at that is if at the start of this economic downturn, in theory, the state should have been able to deliver about a $2 trillion tax cut to help get us out of this economic hole. And all that would do is reset us to inflation-adjusted 2002 levels, not to real 2002 levels. That should be utterly painless. Instead, they need about $300 billion, apparently, from the federal government just to survive, to avoid going into bankruptcy. to avoid actually cutting any services, as it turns out. Right. Now, taxes per capita during that time grew, obviously. I mean, if you think about where that revenue growth come from, it didn't come from, you know, good luck and winnings at gambling. It came from taking more money from us. In 2002, per capita, nationwide per capita average state tax revenue was $1,862. By 07, it was just under $2,500. So that's a 33% real increase, which basically is about three times what inflation would have increased that tax revenue alone. So there were a lot of tax increases buried in that 5 years. So here we were in boom economic times. And here, there, a cigarette tax there, a sales tax here. We had a three times increase in per capita tax revenue. Now, some of that was because we had economic growth, maybe that exceeded the normal inflation adjustment rate, but they were raking in an awful lot of revenue. And they were spending it, of course. Expenditures in 2002 were $1 trillion. Remember, revenue in 2002 was $1 trillion. So they were bringing in $1 trillion and spending $1 trillion. In 07, spending was $1.4 trillion, but remember, revenue was $2.2 trillion. So in 07, states were sitting on big budget surpluses. In 08, they needed $300 billion in bailouts from the government. Amazing how elastic the accounting is at the government level, isn't it? So that's a 28% increase in spending, a real 28% increase, which is about 50% more than what the increase in expenditures would need to be in order to maintain that 2002 level services again. Between 02 and 07, they spent about $300 billion, that 50% more than you needed to maintain 2002 levels is about $300 billion. I already mentioned that, meanwhile, things like your unemployment, your typical measures of demand were falling. So they were socking this money away into all kinds of programs that don't have a lot to do with inflation and population growth. The biggest spending states, I thought this might be interesting since some of you may live or own property in some of these states. Arizona, number one. You moved there just in time, right in the middle.
Right, exactly.
It's always good to arrive after they've ratcheted it up, right? So then you get to pay for it all without getting any of the benefits. Arizona, Wyoming, New Mexico, Delaware, and Florida are the top states. I should say I'm leaving out two other top states were Louisiana and Mississippi, but they're spending so distorted by Hurricane Katrina recovery that those numbers are completely bogus. But those other five states are just high-spending, high-rolling states in the last 5 years. Interesting thing is where the spending grew and where the spending shrunk. Because believe it or not, in all of this, they actually... Let me rephrase that. I'm falling into their trap. nowhere did spending actually decrease that I could find. But there were places where the rate of increase in spending was considerably below the growth of population and inflation. So in other words, spending wasn't keeping up with growth in some sectors. But it's interesting what those sectors are. Places where the states increased spending much, much more, I mean, in many cases, more than 100% faster than the growth in the economy is public welfare. During a boom, obviously, you've got to more than double welfare spending because unemployment's falling, so get it? education, because apparently there is no number large enough to solve our education problem. Interest on debt. Hospitals and salaries and benefits. Hiring people, the state and local government employment exploded during this boom. The per capita number of state employees increased more than 50% during this boom. It's just amazing. The places where they reduced spending was government administration. That's good. Highways, prisons, police, law enforcement, courts, healthcare, and parks and recreation. That's a little bit of an odd mix, but it's interesting that, you know, sort of if I was put in charge to implement, you know, the 10-year libertarian revolution plan, I know where I would start getting the government out of things and where I would finish. And I would finish with things like infrastructure, you know, the core services that, you know, even the founding fathers said, well, there's a government role in some of these things. We could probably unwind most of that. But they're growing spending during the boom on the things that make the least sense, and they're actually decreasing, they're spending below the rate of inflation on the core things, the things that are long-term investments where we actually get benefits from. Pretty much everybody in this room gets zero from the things that they increased, and we all get benefits from the things that they decreased for the most part. And that so the spending's upside down with the actual priorities of taxpayers. The bad thing about this is everybody's probably familiar with the lock-in effect. When the state increases spending like this during a boom, they certainly can't cut it during a bad economy because that's when people need more services, right? It's an insidious thing that they increase spending and revenues during an economic boom because it creates this ratchet effect. This is exacerbated by the stimulus, because now they're saying, in order to avoid having to cut anything, we need the federal government to give us a pile of debt-financed money. And there's around between $100 and $300 billion, depending on how you want to slice it, you know, because what's $200 billion here or there, is going out through state and local governments. So it's essentially just going into their budgets to spend on things that they, in theory, were already going to do if they'd had the money themselves. Interestingly, during all that, so that's all a problem. That's all the sort of anti-privatization story. And yet, during all of this, something Bob told me when I first came to work at Reason, he did work there before me, and which I've learned now having been at Reason through a few recessions, is whenever there's an economic downturn, demand for privatization, the demand from the government to implement privatization goes up. It doesn't matter. In some sense, all these big moving pictures are the big story that we're constantly fighting. We're constantly trying to say, look, growing government in this way is bad, and there's good fundamental reasons why. Privatization offers a sort of permanent solution. You know, if you've privatized your trash collection like Phoenix has, the costs and revenues for the city of Phoenix in the trash collection haven't gone up like this in 2002, because they don't have any of it. It's private. So, you know, this is a permanent solution to this problem. That idea remains, and the economy puts this kind of pressure on people that makes them motivated customers, and that's where we get involved, looking at all these opportunities, deciding which ones are real and which ones are probably a waste of time. You know, where are we actually going to get implementation? Because that's where the rubber meets the road for us, is it's great to do research on privatization, but the really great thing is when somebody privatizes something, and we want to help them do it. And so Len's going to talk about where we've decided the best opportunities are in the next year or two.
Thanks, Adrian. Well, first, before I get to that, I just want to make a couple of just observations. I spent, in my introduction, yes, I do get a lot of frequent flyer miles. I spend a lot of time on the plane, and I have a lot of time to think about what is the problem here. And so just a couple of just quick observations on that. First of all, I just have to say, in the free market movement, it's become increasingly apparent to me that the disproportional focus on tax cuts and the lack of a proportional focus on spending is a problem. Now, look, I'm all for tax cuts. I'm a big fan of tax cuts, but those are the easy part. It's easy to sell the public on tax cuts. It's harder to sell them on spending. So I would say, instead of focusing so much attention that the free market movement does on tax cuts, we should actually spend that much attention on the spending side, because the tax cuts are easier. It's harder to cut spending. Also, I mean, we have a bit, you know, why do we have this rampant spending, this drunken sailor spending that we see? And one of the problems is that there's just a default assumption in state and local and, well, government budgeting that last year's dollar was a good dollar spent, so next year we'll start with that amount, and then we'll put a little bit more into it because, of course, we have inflation. And so you just have this perpetual cycle where nobody, you know, very, now I don't want to say nobody, there are a few places, and increasingly so, interest in tying budgets to performance, and so you don't have the automatic increases, decreases, that sort of baseline budgeting approach. But that is a fundamental problem, just assuming that, hey, what we did last year worked, so let's do it again this year with a little more. In terms of privatization, you just have inherently in government this default presumption of government monopoly service provision. Somebody comes up with a great idea. Let's start some new program, right? Well, how does that thing get implemented? They kind of skip the step of, well, how should we do it? And go right to, okay, well, we need a government bureaucracy, and we need public employees, and blah, blah, blah. So you have that. Well, then you also have this this perception or belief that, you know, government is a jobs program, and we see that constantly today. In fact, more so. In fact, as the private sector, as jobs, if you look at employment in the private sector, you know, we've seen these numbers. I don't have the latest number, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs lost in the private sector since the crunch. Well, how about public jobs? Where have they gone? Down or up? up. Exactly. And there was a great thing in the USA Today this week about, you know, Phoenix, where I live. I moved in at the right time. Of course, I come, you know, moving there, and they're getting hit with a, you know, budget shortfall, and they're talking about, we need to cut 1,000 jobs, et cetera, and talking about all these closing parks and pools and all sorts of services. And USA Today had a great piece the other day where they said, well, what's really happening out there? You know, state, and they the takeaway was basically that state and local governments have actually not been hit quite as hard as they're saying. And in fact, in Phoenix, where they're threatening thousands of jobs, well, they only actually cut 10 jobs in the whole city. Now, they say it's 1,000 because they basically just left positions unfilled, like 1,000 positions unfilled. So that's losing 1,000 jobs. But in reality, it was only 10 people got their job taken away. And at the same time, the city of Phoenix increased the pay scale for public employees and their benefit package this year. I mean, in the middle of all this. So that's, you know, part of the problem here is this government is a jobs program, and that same thing plays itself out on the national scale. So, you know, really, how do you target these two things? And it's really a tag team. It's dealing with budgeting and budgeting for outcomes, performance-based budgeting, that type of approach. You've got to hit the, you know, that side of it. And then, well, are we? You have to hit the right-sizing government, the privatization, competition, that the other side, and if you have those two things in place, you can do a lot of you can maybe reverse course or steer the ship in a different direction. So now, just who's doing what out there, and what are we seeing? Who are we working with? Right now, I mean, there's a lot, but the two biggest ones right now are Louisiana for me, Louisiana and Arizona. In Louisiana, Governor Jindal and his staff brought me in to. It started with advising his cabinet, or coming in and giving a presentation to his entire cabinet last November, because the governor and his staff basically realized, okay, guys, and they basically inherit a bunch of legacy staff, lifers who've been around for decades, you know, people who aren't really prone to changing things. And so they decided, well, we need to get these guys and shake them up a little bit. So they decided to have a two-day budget retreat and bring in a bunch of speakers and whatnot to talk about new ideas, cutting-edge reforms, etc. And so I got to be part of that and go in and give a presentation to his cabinet on privatization and public-private partnerships. And that evolved into a relationship where I've been working with him for several months now to develop, a couple of different things. In fact, he just announced them with his budget. He produced his budget a proposal about a month ago, and with that, a series of reforms, and two of them I worked on them directly with. One, civil service reform, which is a big one. Then that basic civil service reform basically gets at the issue of things like seniority, bumping rights, tenure, those types of issues in civil service. Because essentially, it's basically unlocking the lock that we typically have on government employees. I mean, basically, they're protected from everything. So one of the big reforms, and a couple of other states have done this, Florida and Georgia included, civil service reform. And so that was one piece of it. Another thing I've been working with him on, and he just announced this, was a commission on streamlining government, which is a nice fancy name for what can we privatize and what can we get rid of. And that's basically what they're going to be looking at, doing a scrub across state government of what do we... I mean, they've already cut 100 obsolete commissions and whatnot out there, so that this has already started, and this commission on streamlining government will then kind of pick up the ball and run with it and really get into the nitty-gritty of service provision. So that's Louisiana, and it's exciting, because I lived in Louisiana. I lived in New Orleans for several years, and back then in the mid-90s, I would have told you Louisiana would be the last place on the planet that will touch government reform. And, you know, and I hate to say this, but, you know, one of the things that got swept out with the hurricane was, you know, some degree of that, you know, insulated and sort of resistance that was sort of endemic in Louisiana political culture. Arizona, likewise, I've got a bill running right now, and this is a great one. Several years ago in Florida here, we helped Governor Bush set up something called the Council on Efficient Government. And essentially, it's the same kind of thing as that Jindal Commission. But this one is actually a permanent apparatus in state government whose job is, you could sort of summarize it as a center of excellence in state procurement, and basically helping agencies identify privatization opportunities and then helping them do it, implement it with the due diligence that, you know, the public demands in situations like that. And so I took that model and I developed a bill out of it to basically replicate that concept. And now when this started happening, I was thinking, well, you know, maybe one state. I'd be lucky if I got into one state. And I had a friend who's in the legislature in Arizona who I gave the bill to. And it turns out the Chamber of Commerce got on top of it. They loved it. Obviously, this is a good time for business. So they are actually, they've made it one of their three priority bills to establish this sort of privatization commission. And takes away a lot of the work on my shoulders because they've got their team of lobbyists out there hounding down legislators. So that's one that's really exciting. But then that same bill, all of a sudden, it was just this cascade of people asking me for stuff like that. So now that same bill is running in, it's in Arizona, Illinois, Oklahoma, and, well, Alaska's looking at it, but Alaska's a goofy, anomaly out there among the states in terms of, budgets and spending, so I don't think there's any pressure up there. But it's interesting that concept went from basically, very little activity over the last 5 years to, boom, there's a bunch of states looking at it, not to mention local governments as well. Also, public-private partnerships. Bob spent some time talking about PPP legislation for toll roads, and that's another thing that we have going in Arizona right now. We have a bill that, and I've been working on this for years, but this year, none of these bills that I've been working on in Arizona on PPP toll roads ever got anywhere the last 2 years. This year, the pressure, everything changed. Now you had the bill go out of the House by 53-1 about 2 weeks ago for public-private partners. All the Democrats, unanimous Democrats, almost unanimous Republicans. It was really stunning. But so what else are we seeing out there? I just want to give a quick little wrap up before we take some questions. There's a lot going on privatization right now. Governor Perdue in Georgia has a lot of different initiatives. IT systems, big billion, multi-billion dollar IT revamps. Another really cutting edge one is state psychiatric hospitals. Basically, they are the quality in the state psychiatric hospitals of Georgia has deteriorated to the point where they're basically being threatened by the Department of Justice with civil rights violations, and basically saying, "Look, clean up your act by X date, or we will, let everyone sue you for the abysmal quality of care." And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution ran a series on this about a year ago, where they found over the last couple years about 130. Deaths, abuses, all sorts of, it's just a grim story. And so Governor Perdue is saying, look, we're going to tap the private sector. They know how to do this. They're doing it here in Florida. And we're going to privatize all of them. So, I think they have seven, if I remember correctly. So that's a big initiative, and that's, relatively fresh turf for lots of other states out there to be watching. You have cities. Indianapolis, one of the leaders in privatization back in the day, they are deciding to get back into it, and the mayor there just rolled out a set of initiatives to apply managed competition, let public and private compete to provide services for about 11 different areas, grounds, maintenance, vehicle fleet, all sorts of things. L.A., which I love. This is great. L.A., the last bastion. They're talking about privatizing zoos, the convention center, parking meters. That's a big one right now. So there's even places like Los Angeles. And just to put some more perspective on that, lots of blue states are looking at this stuff too. Places that have told you they will never touch this. Well, they are. A couple of examples, Michigan. Michigan set up a commission to, not even a commission, they set up an apparatus in state government to start looking at what can we, what for our infrastructure needs, what sort of public-private partnership should we be looking at? What can we sell, lease, and tap the private sector to build? And that's Michigan. And they didn't even go to they went past the step of just creating some little commission to, report in. They actually set it up from the beginning as a shop in state government. New York has something, they have a commission that they've set up, but that's, again, New York. Again, one of those last bastions of places that you would never think would take off on privatization. Well, yeah, they are. And they're looking at everything, lotteries, roads, all sorts of things, prisons. So you've got a lot out there on that front. Well, with that, I think, how much time do we have, Amy? Is this time for questions?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
I'll go ahead and wrap that up. I did want to just say one quick thing about the federal government, if I could. Maybe I'll go in a reverse direction here, but as much good stuff as we're seeing on privatization in state and local government right now, it's kind of the reverse situation in the federal government. At least it looks that way so far. Basically, so far in the last couple months, well, and this has really been building up for a couple years now, but we've seen attempts to kill competitive sourcing. Again, it's that, you know, letting public and private compete to provide services. Obama came in and said, well, we want to do more in-house. just came in with a blanket statement. We want to reduce contracting by, 10%, some arbitrary number, and we want to do more, beef up our personnel and do more in-house. They want to switch their contracting methods. And they also, the most recent thing was they want to extend de facto civil service protections to contractors. Essentially, what they want to do is basically, if you have a contract with the federal government right now, and then they rebid it, and then somebody else wins, they want to make the new guy hire the old guy's employees. Which, now that happens in privatization, government to private. I mean, that happens all the time. You know, the government says, well, we're only going to privatize if you accept like 90-some percent of our employees or, something like that. I mean, that happens all the time, but not private to private. And so, now there's fear out there that this is going to extend civil service provisions to the private sector if you're a government contractor. So, but the beautiful thing, and Matt, if you look at the intro to the latest Reason magazine, Matt has a great intro to that, and it talks about the truth versus the reality of what Obama says, or this sort of doublespeak. And so you have all those things that I just mentioned. Yet, for every one of them, when Obama or his cronies talk about it, they say that this is going to increase competition. And it's like, what planet do you live on? So anyway, we still have some work to do at the federal level, and that's something that Reason is going to be definitely active in over the next couple of years. Because yes, as the to use the tired old target-rich environment, it is.